Well, good morning. Happy Tuesday. It is going to be a hot one.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about the show about chicken wings. I'm talking about the weather outside.
Definitely.
It's going to be steamy, where there's going to be a heat advisory put into place at noon. Temperatures are going to climb near 100 degrees.
Yeah.
99 degrees, I think, was the last time I saw it. And the real fields are going to get up above 100 degrees.
And the city of Detroit opening all of the rec centers and the libraries as cooling centers. So if you need to get cool, you can go to any one of the Detroit rec centers or the libraries here in the city and cool off. And as that extreme heat continues to grip Southeast Michigan, SMART is going to be deploying air-conditioned buses in certain locations across Metro Detroit. The former Pontiac's center in Pontiac, the Phoenix Center in Pontiac, Fairlane Mall, Dearborn, Macomb Mall in Roseville, Southland Mall in Taylor, Bel Air Shopping Center in Detroit, and J.L. Hudson Drive. So there'll be buses, they'll be parked, but that air will be blowing.
That's good. Good news.
Good thing.
Meanwhile, have we figured out what exactly is causing this this parasite, this scourge?
Michigan health officials say lettuce and salad greens are now the leading suspected source of the state's growing Cyclosporiasis outbreak. The Michigan Department of Health and Human Services reporting more than 2,600 cases statewide, far above the 40 to 50 cases Michigan typically sees in an entire year. Investigators have not identified a specific grower or supplier, but officials are urging consumers to buy whole heads of lettuce instead of bag salad mixes. Discard the outer leaves and wash the remaining leaves thoroughly. Cook greens whenever possible to kill the parasite, and health officials say contaminated produce remains the focus of the investigation, while recreational swimming is not believed to be a source of the outbreak.
See, it's the salads have turned on me. See how that works?
Yeah.
I like a good salad.
Me too.
But they've turned. They've turned on me. Oh. We are now adversaries. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to put a blockade on the salad.
You're going to keep the salads from coming in?
Reinstituting the blockade. No more salads.
No more lettuce.
No more lettuce.
Okay.
Much like Donald Trump is reinstituting a blockade in the Strait of Hormuz. He says this is only for Iran, though.
It's a blockade not for anybody but Iran. In other words, anybody doing business with Iran can't go through. Everyone else will be able to go through. So it's a blockade. It's a very strong blockade.
The United States will also charge a 20% fee on cargo moving through the Strait of Hormuz, according to the president. And this is essentially because, according to the president, we need to be reimbursed for that protection.
We are going to be reimbursed for protection. We're protecting by the countries that we're helping.
Don't love it.
No.
Didn't love it when Iran said they were going to do it. When Iran and Oman were huddling together talking about how they were going to squeeze money from these companies.
Yep.
I don't love it. I don't know what, I mean, I think the blockade going back in is probably a good thing at this point. Again, strikes continue. The president said that they those will continue. And, you know, again, what, I don't know what else there is to do at this point. And here was the other thing that kind of upset me. The president yesterday said that we were in Vietnam for 19 years. We're here for like 4 months, so I think we've done a lot. And he was asked if this is the new norm for Americans, and he said that, well, we've knocked out Iran's Navy and Air Force and missile capabilities and drone manufacturers. If we didn't do it, they would have a nuclear weapon. Well, that was not, it was not the time frame that you had set out initially.
Nope.
Now, understanding, if you are dealing with any sort of military action, things change. Okay, I don't think anybody should be held to those numbers. But for those people that were skeptical up front,
yeah,
that this wasn't just going to be a three-month mission, well, all of a sudden those people are going, well, see? Oh, see?
Yeah. And, I mean, you may have wiped, you know, he continues to say he wiped out the military and wiped out the Navy, and he wiped out, you know, they hit the missile bunkers and the missile sites and stuff. But Iran is still shooting missiles.
Correct.
They haven't wiped that all the way out. I'm sure they've depleted them.
No.
But they're still shooting.
The president has certainly oversold, I think, the damage done.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they just, you know, it's like a weed.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, once you cut your dandelion, if you don't treat it, another dandelion's going to come up.
That's right.
So maybe that's the case, but certainly more work needs to be done to protect those in the Strait.
And oil is up as well. I mean, it jumps above $80. I mean, we were talking, what, last week it was, what, $65 for a barrel of oil. Now it's $80, and Brent oil is $86.
Yeah.
So it's gone up. Also, Lindsey Graham. The situation with him, like, who's going to take over now that he has passed away? Well, South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster has appointed Darlene Graham Nordone, the sister of the late Senator Lindsey Graham, to fill his U.S. Senate seat through the remainder of his term. Graham, as you know, died over the weekend at age 71 from what medical examiner says was likely an aortic dissection, a tear in the body's main artery. Nordone has never been elected office, but shared a close bond with her brother, who became her legal guardian after their father's death and later adopted her. She will serve until January, while South Carolina voters elect a senator to a full six-year term in November following the Republican primary in August.
They had a tough life growing up. Mom died young. Dad died young as well, although Lindsey Graham was, I think, 20 years old-ish. Mm-hmm. You mentioned eventually legally adopting his sister to be her guardian. She has done some really good work over the years. She's been helping those with disabilities find jobs. And she talked a lot about what they both actually have in the past about what their relationship has been like over the years.
Yeah.
And losing your parents, obviously young, and having to step into that parental role for Lindsey Graham wasn't easy to do, but he did it, and now she's stepping up, which I think is pretty cool.
Well, yeah, it is a good thing, and we'll see where this turns. The 22-year-old Detroit man arrested in connection with Saturday's deadly shooting at Great Lakes Crossing Mall has been released from jail. No charges have been filed yet. Auburn Hills police say the shooter, a licensed concealed pistol holder, is cooperating with the investigation. According to investigators, the incident began with an altercation inside a food court restroom. Police say two men later confronted and attacked the shooter in the food court, sparking a fight that led to gunfire. A 20-year-old Pontiac man was killed. 19-year-old bystander was treated for non-life-threatening injuries. Meanwhile, Great Lakes Crossing has fully reopened, the operations returning to normal just 48 hours after the violence that took place there. The future of University of Michigan Athletic Director Ward Manuel, well, that could come into focus this week as the Board of Regents meets on Thursday. Multiple reports say the board may discuss a possible buyout of Manuel's contract while the university continues an internal review of the athletic department's culture. Manuel, however, told Yahoo Sports he has no plans to step down, saying he expects to remain athletic director. Manuel has led Michigan Athletics since 2016, overseeing multiple national championships, but his tenure has included high-profile controversies, including the Connor Stallion sign-stealing scandal and the university's response to other investigations. A report on the department's culture could be released later this week.
Yeah, and that was something that we've been waiting for quite some time. It was ordered after the Sharon Moore incident.
Mm-hmm.
But this, from stuff that I'm reading, it sounds like they're could be something in here,
mm-hmm.
and that is what's causing these reports to show that, you know, maybe Ward Manuel's job isn't safe. But a lot of these allegations are stemming from a lawsuit that was filed by a former linebackers coach, Chris Partridge, and certainly we're gonna have to follow that, because that could be a big report when it does become public. Meanwhile, coming up on the other side, we'll get the latest on Iran with Lucas Tomlinson. It's next on JR Morning. So the blockade going back into place, and even a 20% fee to cover the cost of protection,
yes.
The president says will also be put in place. But this only is applying for Iranian vessels.
He
says anybody else that wants to get through that doesn't have ties to Iran can get through. Let's get the latest. Where in the world is Lucas Tomlinson? We ask that every time we talk to him. And turns out he's in Tel Aviv. Good morning, Lucas.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for having me back. Greetings and good morning from Tel Aviv.
So the president says the blockade's going back in place. Sounds like it's going to be later this afternoon. What does that signal towards where we're at in this conflict?
Well, it means the ceasefire and the memorandum of understanding signed with Iran is effectively over. And we're back to where we were about a month ago, in addition to the blockade coming back as ordered from President Trump at 4 p.m. Eastern today. There's been five nights of airstrikes against Iran over the past week, three consecutive. If you remember when President Trump attended the NATO summit in Ankara, Turkey, where yours truly was reporting, it felt like Iran was trying to disrupt that summit by returning to attacking commercial shipping in the Strait of Hormuz. And just yesterday, Iran launched more attacks, this time hitting a pair of Emirati tankers with cruise missiles, killing one sailor and wounding eight. So I just heard the weather report in Detroit. Sounds like it's pretty steamy, over 100. Well, the temperature is turning up here in the Middle East, although I will say here in Israel, it is relatively very quiet. There's not been a rocket incursion since early this month.
Lucas, the president has formally notified Congress that fighting with Iran has resumed. But, you know, lawmakers, they argue he needs to come to Congress and get that congressional approval to continue these military actions. How serious is that constitutional showdown over war powers going to be?
Well, the White House would say that they are fulfilling their constitutional duties by notifying Congress about this resumption of military strikes. Again, five strikes against Iran over the past week, and those notifications were sent. War powers is a tricky one, though, because we look at it's only been around since 1973. And when you look at the list of presidents and how many did all the notifications and followed the letter of the law, a lot of them have frankly skipped it.
Yeah.
Do you get the sense that this is the president has talked a lot about, you know, going the diplomatic route. Do you get the sense there's frustration that we're back here? I mean, he said he didn't want the United States to go into a depression, and he thought maybe that's where we were headed with the cost of oil being so high, right, as that initial blockade was being lifted. It doesn't feel like this was the plan to be back here.
No, and it still seems that for both sides, it doesn't appear like both sides want a return to all-out war. That being said, the president, he said he wanted to bring down oil costs. You certainly have the midterm elections coming up. You have to look at this through a political lens, not just a military one. The problem is, after signing the memorandum of understanding with Iran and what many critics said were very generous terms for Iran, remember, they could sell their oil, the sanctions were going to be lifted. In fact, during the 20-odd days that this memorandum was happening, Iran sold over $5 billion worth of goods. You know, that's like the GDP of St. Lucia. Mm-hmm. You know, Iran made some cash, and for people looking at this from a Western lens, they'd say, well, that sounds like a great deal. They're making billions of dollars. Why not keep going? Well, that's just not how Iran works. And frankly, the Trump administration is dealing with not one, not two, but three different governments inside Iran. And negotiations appear very, very difficult, as we've seen, of course, in the past 4 months since this conflict began.
You know, one of the biggest headlines, I think, is the U.S., you know, using these sea drones in combat for the first time. And, you know, we watched Ukraine and, you know, use those naval drones, you know, really effectively against Russia. Are we seeing the U.S. kind of borrow some lessons from that battle?
There's no question. This is something that Admiral Brad Cooper, the CENTCOM commander, pushed when he was in charge of Fifth Fleet, all naval forces in the Middle East. You're right. We've seen those drones effectively destroy the Russian fleet in the Black Sea. What makes it difficult, not only it's not just that they're remote controlled, but, you know, very small radar signature. You know, these things are skimming the waves. Probably don't even show up on radar. You know, you don't have the big freeboard like you would see from a warship. And very devastating. We saw sea drones being used for the first time from the U.S. military in history just yesterday. U.S. Central Command putting out the video. And certainly there's no question the U.S. military taking a lot of lessons learned from the Ukrainians.
So as the military action kind of ramps up here, what are our allies in the region? What are those communications with the United States like? Are they on board with what's happening here?
Well, certainly with the Gulf states, and, you know, unlike the U.S. military, posting videos of F-18s, F-35 from Lincoln, you know, launching off the deck of the aircraft carrier, you know, Emiratis, others, they're a lot quieter when they go about their work. In fact, just as I called in to you guys this morning, there were some explosions reported in Bandar Abbas, Iran's largest naval base. And typically, the U.S. military does most of their work at night, as you guys know. And by the way, President Trump in the Oval Office said, in addition to all the strikes I just mentioned, he says more are coming tonight. And we heard his interview with Hugh Hewitt, where he talked about Pickaxe Mountain, which has long been a suspected nuclear site around the Natanz region between Tehran and Isfahan. That is perhaps on the target list. And President Trump, I believe he said something along the lines of he's going to give him a big fat shot.
That could be it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting as always, Lucas Tomlinson. We appreciate your time. Thank you. Stay safe over there, and we'll talk again soon.
Appreciate it, fellas. No promise.
Yeah. All right, Luke.
You got it.
See ya.
Again, we wanted a different outcome, and then things. This is what we'd been talking about for a long time, which was this is Iran's MO.
Mm-hmm.
Is behind closed doors, they're like, yeah, of course. Let's get to a deal.
Yep.
Nobody wants this, right, guys? We don't want to do this anymore. Let's stop. And then publicly, they sell a different story to their people.
Yes, because everything is shut down. People don't; they can't get information. They only can get what they are told.
I mean, and then of course, the United States is the boogeyman.
Of course,
okay,
yeah.
You're paying us that way. That's fine. That's how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
But then all of a sudden, you're weeks and weeks down the road with no real developments, no real momentum in the right direction. And then next thing you know, we're sending sea drones into ports and we're attacking missile sites and silos and things like that. And now we're back at it.
And does Iran really, who are we talking to? I mean, we're negotiating with one set of people, but we have another set up there who are doing what they want to do, okay. You know? So are we talking to the right people? They're not communicating together.
This is why why people say this is like a regime change proof country because of their structure. Coming up on the other side, Lindsey Graham died from a tear in his aorta. What is an aortic dissection? We'll talk about that on the other side. It's Jared Morning. So Lindsey Graham dies at 71 years old, and according to at least the preliminary medical report, was that there was a tear in his aorta.
Yeah.
An aortic dissection. What is that?
I don't know.
It sounds incredibly severe.
It does.
And it ultimately took Lindsey Graham's life. How do you even detect something like this? Something that we hope Dr. Alessandro Vivacqua, the director of the Aortic Center at Corwell Health, William Beaumont Hospital in Royal Oak, can help dumb down for us, because it sounds very serious and very complicated. Doc, good morning. It's good to have you.
Good morning, and thank you for having me in your show.
So tell us a little bit about what an aortic dissection is and obviously the ramifications of having something like that.
Yeah. So an aortic dissection, as the word says, is a disease of the aorta. The aorta is the biggest artery that we have and brings the blood from the heart to all the body. And what happened, the wall of the aorta has three layers. And so a dissection is actually a tear in the inner layer of the wall. And now the blood penetrates into the wall and dissects, means separates the layers of the aortic wall. And this caused two bad things. One is that the wall is now weaker and can rupture. And the other one is that this separation of layers caused what we call a flap. And this flap can obstruct or significantly decrease the blood flow to pretty much all your body.
Mm.
And so this becomes a medical emergency, because those situations, they are really life-threatening.
Doctor, to me, one of the most shocking things is that someone can appear perfectly healthy and then just suddenly collapse. How can this happen with so little warning?
Yes, correct. That's the main issue. And that's also is a reason why many of those diseases are underdiagnosed, because there are no warning signs. So most of the patients, they already have what is called an aneurysm of the aorta, which is silent, doesn't give any symptoms. And so pretty much you don't have anything until 30 seconds before this happens, and it's very catastrophic.
Mm. How common is this in younger people? How common is it for for older folks to come down with one of these tears in their aorta?
Yeah, so it's pretty estimated that there are about 13,000 cases in America for aortic dissection every year. And it's and there is a number of those, is calculated about 50% of people that they don't even make to the hospital, so they don't have a diagnosis. And it's just people that suddenly died. And it's most common usually in men with above 50, 60, 70 years old. And then there is another group of patients that accounts for about 20% of the cases. There are people that have a genetic disease, so means they were born with this, and there are like people like they have Marfan syndrome, or they have what we call a bicuspid aortic valve. So the aortic valve is this valve that is between your heart and the aorta, and it opens when the heart squeezes the blood to go to all the body, and then when the heart fills, it closes so the blood doesn't go backwards. So this aorta has three flaps usually, but in about 2% of the patient is has only two, what we call bicuspid, and this is another risk factor. And so there is about those kind of genetic disease, they manifest early in life. So it's more common in younger patients, the 20, 30, or 40s. And then there is another small amount of dissection that can happen if some people use like cocaine, or they have a physical trauma like a car accident or a significant fall. Mm. So mainly older people, male, but in a small population can be much younger. Mm.
Doctor, if someone, let's just say someone has a close relative who's had an aortic dissection, should they be screened even if they feel perfectly healthy?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's very important to know if there is a, what we call a family history, because we know that those dissection and aneurysms, which is the precondition usually of dissection, they run into families. So it's very important that you get screened. There is, we have the availability to do some genetic testing to see if there is a genes that cause this and runs into family. And then it's very important to get screened, to talk with a doctor, get at least an echocardiogram or a CAT scan to see if you have any of this enlargement of the aorta that we call aneurysm. And if this is the case, it's very important that this is follow up very closely, because we can look if there is any change in size, then we have to intervene early to avoid that a dissection or a rupture happens.
Dr. Alessandro Vivacqua, thank you for your time and insight on this. Certainly important for people to know. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's something, the scary part, like once again, the scary part is that someone can, you know,
yeah,
feel great, and then the next moment they don't.
Right.
I mean, and according to a lot of witnesses, you know, he said, Lindsey Graham said he didn't feel well, and people told him, hey, you need to go to the doctor and mm-hmm. get that checked out. He says, okay, well, I'll do it after my hit tomorrow on, you know, Meet the Press.
Yeah.
And it didn't get to that.
Mm.
You know.
That's scary. Yeah. Have you seen this video of this buffalo? This
yes,
bison?
I did.
Okay. Walk us through exactly what happened here.
So the bison basically saw this grandfather and his grandson, or son, or father and son, and came at them and came after the father and ran up behind him and flipped him up in the air. It looks like about 10 feet. He came down. He severely, I think he fractured his femur in several places, and he lies still, and I think that kind of saved his life. I mean, I think he lied still because he was knocked out, and the bison didn't continue, because
right.
usually bisons, but from, it was a zoo director who was on TV yesterday, and he said basically what the problem is, this is the time of year where bison are looking for, male bison are looking for females, and their hormones are just going crazy. And they're just like, their mind is just gone. And anything will set them off because they want to fight because they've been fighting because they're trying to get this.
Fighting over females.
Over females.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and the person who took the actual film of this happening said he saw the bison before this happened rolling around in the dust.
There's video of that. Yeah.
Just going nuts. And they think that truck, it was a truck that went past, you know, the bison. They think because the bison was laying down. They think the truck blew the horn in the truck,
fight mode for
it was like,
bison.
Oh, you're challenging me.
Yeah,
you know,
this was happening at Yellowstone National Park, and Carl Isom McDaniel was the man visiting when he got attacked. Sounds like he's going to be all right.
No, he's going to be okay.
But a little worse for wear.
Yeah, you know, and he's still here, thank the Lord.
Scary stuff. Meanwhile, engineers are using thermal advances and AI to extend car life. What does that mean for those who fix our cars? It's coming up on JR Morning. Well, despite years of signals or predictions that we were headed towards a mass adoption of electric vehicles, what we're seeing is automakers and suppliers still very much heavily investing in ICE technology and blending in some new age technology and well. And all of this is in an effort to help extend your car's life, whether that's through artificial intelligence or different thermal advances. It's very fascinating. It's the topic for Mobility Makers this morning. And Richard Truitt, the engineering and technology reporter at the Automotive News, joins us to break it down. Richard, good morning. It's good to have you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about what exactly is going on here, because there has been a bit of a shift away from electric vehicles, not totally, but from the big three, for example. They've pulled back the reins. And so that means they still are producing, you know, highly sought after vehicles that have internal combustion engines. How are they mixing in some of the new technology with the old?
Well, I tell you, you would think that after about 135 years or so that there wouldn't be very much they could do to the traditional gasoline engine, but that's completely wrong, because not only are Stellantis and Ford and GM and others making the engine more efficient, but the supplier community is really stepping up with some really cool technology. The big focus is on what they call thermal efficiency. About a third of the energy in gasoline is actually used to turn the wheels of the car. The rest is wasted out the exhaust pipe and lost in friction inside the engine. And suppliers and automakers are working to capture more of that energy. So I think that's where the big focus is.
Richard, when we hear that engineers are using AI to make, you know, these engines more durable, what does that actually mean? I mean, is AI designing better engines?
Well, it can help engineers design better engines, but it's also, and this might be the most important thing, it's also teaching engineers how to test engines in different ways. And I think that the testing of engines is really important, because how they perform under duress at different temperatures with different fuels, all these learnings can come together in ways that would have taken maybe years before. Can happen really quickly now.
Mm. Which one do you think the automakers and suppliers are signaling could be the biggest change, the most impactful change for them?
Well, I tell you what, we in Detroit, we do a lot of griping about the Chinese auto industry, but let's just step back a second and take a look at one thing. Yes, the Chinese auto industry has a lot of government help, whether we like that or not, they do. But on the other hand, these are smart, motivated people and really good engineers, and they should be, because guess what? We taught them what they know. Jeep was one of the first automakers in China in the 1980s, and they went to school on the best engineers in the world, ours. They are doing some really cool stuff. Now, there's a company over there called Geely, which owns Volvo and Polestar and Lotus and some other automakers, and they have created a gasoline engine that is about 50% thermally efficient. The average engine today is maybe in the 30s. We're seeing Stellantis do some really cool stuff. They have an engine out now called the Hurricane 4, which is in the Jeep Grand Cherokee, that uses Formula One racing technology and makes the four-cylinder engine makes 324 horsepower. Think about that. The Hemi engine, when it came out a few years ago, made roughly that same amount of engine. That was a V8. Now we're getting that kind of power out of a four-cylinder.
You know, Richard, just for the average driver who's planning to keep a vehicle, let's say 10, 15 years, could these engineering advances kind of translate into fewer repairs and lower maintenance costs?
Well, I wish that were the case, but here's, well, you really picked on a sensitive topic, because yes, technology is advancing, but is reliability advancing along with it? And I have to say at this point, no, it's not. And it might not have to do with technology, but more to do with automakers using parts that might get them through the warranty period, but not much past that. And I'm talking about plastic engine parts in cooling systems and things like that, timing chains. No, I think the automakers could do a lot better job of building engines that are more durable.
Really interesting. Fascinating to see what these companies are doing now. We appreciate your time. Richard Truitt, thank you. We'll talk soon.
Yep, thank you.
Yeah, great piece in the Automotive News.
Wow. Tell you, man, you know, technology is something. But, you know, look down the road, man, one day, and, you know, these AI could tell you when a part's going to maybe
fail or
something before it fails.
When it's weakening.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's something else. I mean, I think most people are keeping their cars as long as they can now. And now probably more than ever.
Yes.
Because the cost of cars are more expensive now than they ever have been. And so, you know, trying to keep up with the maintenance. I mean, Brian will tell you after all this time on the car show, right? It's like, just do your regular maintenance and the rest of your car will hold up. The longevity will be there.
Correct. We've had
am I crazy?
No, you're correct.
I didn't think Brian wanted to talk to us this morning. I was offended.
Jason, shut my microphone off. I'm taking that as personally. No, we've had people on the car show that have over 1,000,000 miles on their car, and it's just from doing maintenance.
It's just from like
change the oil, check the tires, make sure all the fluids are good, check your battery.
You know, and
it's all basic, simple stuff.
You know.
Now, it's all stuff everybody hates to do.
Of course.
Yeah.
You wait to the last minute like some people that I won't discuss.
Yep.
That's why you pay somebody to do it.
I thought this was a safe space.
Everybody's coming at him. Everybody's coming.
But no, I mean, I think that's the thing here is, how do you keep your vehicle longer?
Yeah.
Right.
What do you have to do to keep this thing going as long as possible?
We're also like finding out that more people are repairing their own cars to save that money, too.
Kind of like what you do for yourself.
Yeah, I don't do that.
You know.
Yeah, like I don't need lettuce anymore.
Okay, here we go.
Oh, self-care.
No, Bryce.
Self-care. Self-care is not eating lettuce in 2026. 7 o'clock hour coming up. It's Jer Morning. All right, 7 o'clock hour. Going to be a hot and spicy one today. It's going to feel like it's over 100 degrees.
It will.
It is. I'll tell you, when it gets that hot, it's just hard to leave your house. It's hard to leave the office. If you want to go get lunch in the afternoon, it's tough.
Because even if you are out when it's hot like that and you're like under a tree, under shade, and you get a breeze, the breeze is hot, it's muggy.
Oh, yeah. No, it's stuffy and
it's
wet.
Not right.
And, yeah.
Like, you know.
Do you guys have automatic starts on your car?
I do.
Do you do that in the summer? Will you start your car? If you run into the grocery store and on your way out, will you start your car?
I haven't. My wife does now. Now she'll
do it. I
do it
all the time.
My wife. I do it more in the wintertime.
Well, yeah, for sure in the winter. But in the summer,
I don't. I probably should.
It's a hack you will enjoy.
Because when you step in the car after your car has been sitting out there, it's pretty warm. Yeah.
Not if I just run in the grocery store. The car doesn't. But if my car's been outside for 4 or 5 hours in the sun and I'm going somewhere, yeah, I'll start it up to let it cool off. But just running in and out of the grocery stores, I feel like I've had.
I mean, if you're in there for 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, that's how long do you stay in a grocery store? What are you doing in there?
I'm sticking my head in the freezer.
Yeah. I know that's right. True.
Oh, I forgot. I got to go on with the rest of my day.
Jason brings a beach chair and he sets it up in the ice cream aisle.
You remember that Married with Children episode where they did that? Their air conditioner broke and they went to the grocery store and they were living in the grocery store.
With the fans.
Kroger shoppers, there's a man without his shirt in the freezer section. Please keep children away from there.
I won't do that to anybody. I'll keep my shirt on. Do you guys...
He'll keep his shirt on, Brian.
Do you guys have...
Everything else is totally fine.
There you go.
Do you guys have one of those cell phone holders on your dashboard?
I don't.
I do not.
So every time, and I park in the garage at home. So like I was out over the weekend, and whenever the car parks in the hot sun, your cell phone holder just falls.
Yes.
And you're like, you get in the car, man down. But it always amazes me. You get in the car, you put it back, and you just restick it, and that thing sticks again.
Yeah.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
But it is going to be hot today. So don't take your dog places. Leave your dog at home where it's nice and cool.
That's right. Don't leave your kid in the car.
Don't leave your kids in the car.
For 2 seconds because you're just going to run into the store.
Or like Brian,
second.
He just runs in for 2 seconds. The car doesn't get hot immediately.
Don't do that.
Yeah.
I'm not here for enjoyment. I'm mission oriented.
But no, that's right.
Are you just picking up one thing?
That's me too. I know what I want.
If it's four things, I know where they at. I hit them and I'm out.
And I'm out. That's me.
Hit it and get it.
Wow.
That's it.
Yep. I'm never in the. I mean, very rarely. I mean, I guess if you got to get one thing, I'll run in and be like, oh, we need bananas. I'll go in and grab bananas and get out of there.
Yeah.
But
you know, like milk, lunch meat, bread.
Yeah.
If you know where all of it is, you boom, 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 boom.
And out.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we have, with the kids, it's like bigger orders.
Oh, well, of course. Yeah. I don't have two hungry boys at home. Yeah.
I cannot.
Exactly.
We can't take them to the grocery store.
Absolutely not.
Or we'll be there for hours.
Oh, God, no.
They'll be picking stuff off.
Avoid the candy aisle.
Dad, can I have goldfish? Dad, can we get chips? Dad, can we get candy? No. No, you can't have any of it.
Well, I don't go to the market if I'm hungry.
Yeah, I do. Because
I'll just start picking up stuff. It's like, dude, you know you don't, but you're just hungry.
True.
And you're stuck. You know what I mean?
You're so like, everything sounds good.
Exactly. Yeah. So
I've come home many times and was forgot to have a little something to eat before he went to the grocery store. What do you mean? He's like, a lot of Little Debbie cakes in there.
The worst is going through the deli section when you are hungry.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And got like all that and the rotisserie chickens and all that. Ugh.
But if you go through like a Costco or a Sam's where they have the little samples, you can probably fill up.
I've seen it.
Sir, you've been here for 15 minutes. We're going to have to ask you to leave.
I've seen people like hit one and they'll like 10 minutes later come across them again and they're back at it.
Back at it. Oh, absolutely.
I'm picturing Lloyd with little toothpicks between all of his fingers walking through Costco.
He's like Wolverine.
Yeah.
Just wear my Charlie Chaplin glaces and mustache.
Exactly. Hey. Exactly. Jesus, got to change of clothes.
I come out, I fill up, man. I feel good, man. I'm a nice and full when I come out of those stores.
One thing maybe that you shouldn't buy at the grocery store right now is lettuce.
Michigan health officials say lettuce and salad greens, now the leading suspected source of the state's growing cyclosporiasis outbreak. The Michigan Department of Health and Human Services says more than 2,600 cases statewide here in Michigan, far above the normal 40 to 50 cases that Michigan typically sees in an entire year. Investigators have not identified a specific grower or supplier, but officials are urging consumers to buy whole heads of lettuce instead of the bag salad mixes and discard the outer leaves of the whole head of lettuce. Wash it, wash those remaining leaves thoroughly, and cook greens whenever possible. That will kill the parasite. Now, health officials say contaminated produce remains the focus of the investigation, while recreational swimming is not believed to be a source of the outbreak. A lot of people thought maybe, you know, you get a little swim water in your mouth, you could get it too, but I guess they say no. That's not part of it.
Just the lettuce at the moment. Well,
right.
They're saying that they're not excluding anything else.
Exactly.
But this is what's happened in the past. Lettuce has been the culprit.
And it's like 33 states, but we have the most cases in Michigan, and we had 44 people in the hospital because of it.
Well, and our cases almost doubled from Friday to Monday.
Right.
Thanks to me.
So it was, you know, it's 2640. Was 2639, and then you added the one, so now it's 2640.
I'll tell you, that's a heck of a thing. Meanwhile, Donald Trump.
It's a blockade not for anybody but Iran. In other words, anybody doing business with Iran can't go through. Everyone else will be able to go through. So it's a blockade. It's a very strong blockade.
President says the blockade is coming back in Iran as they continue to hit them militarily. And the president argued that the United States should be compensated from securing this shipping lane, proposing a 20% cargo fee the administration has not talked about how that would work, if it's actually going to be put into place. There's been no Venmo account set up to collect from these cargo ships. So I don't know how that's exactly going to work, but if it's going to work.
But didn't they say Iran couldn't do it because this is international waters and Iran can't do it?
Yeah, so you don't have the ability to do that. I don't know why the U.S. has the ability to do that.
We're just kind of seeing things changing in real time.
It's we're security now in the Strait.
That's what it looks like.
I mean,
we're the police.
Well, that's okay, but that's fine. Except we can't cry about it when they talk about it.
Right. You know,
I think we should be
do as I say, not as I do.
Yeah, equally critical across the plane.
Yeah.
Coming up on the other side, several states are suing Paramount over this proposed merger with Warner Brothers. We'll tell you if Michigan's involved and what it means for your entertainment coming up next. But first at 7:12, time for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rack your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial tech and startup community here on WJR.
Good morning. There are certain tactics and strategies in business today that are just, well, fundamentally required. And one of those today, whether you're doing outreach to new customers or to your existing customers, is the use of personalization in all of your outbound communication. Customers simply expect it today, and without it, at the very least, you're leaving business on the table. And now we've got new data to support this, as evidenced by a new study from Target NXT titled Email Pulse 2026. Now, just to be clear, personalization in marketing is the practice of tailoring messages, offers, and experiences to individual customers based on their preferences, behaviors, and demographic data. That information you've been able to learn about them through your direct correspondence with them and experience with them interacting with your various platforms. Marketing personalization involves using customer data to create customized experiences that feel relevant to each individual customer. This can include personalized emails addressing them by name, for example, in the opening, product recommendations of relevancy and interest to them based on what you've learned about them previously, targeted advertisements, content suggestions that reflect a customer's past interactions and purchases. The goal is to make customers feel that the brand understands their needs and interests and markets directly to them accordingly. Data shows that the use, for example, of personalized emails are more likely to convert. 73% of customers prefer brands that tailor communications directly to them. Personalization also drives loyalty beyond initial purchases. Either way, whether a new customer or an existing customer, it simply helps you drive more business. Now, the average ROI on a dollar spend in personalization ranges from $39 to $45, according to the study, for every dollar spent. So wondering how you get started with personalization? Well, starting at the easiest level first, simply have all of your outbound correspondents go to your customers using their first name when you address them. There are many tools that can help you do just that on an automated basis. And at a fundamental level, start with that. Certainly, you can go way beyond, but that's a starting point that's meaningful. Clement D., founder and CEO of Target Next, said this, "Buyers and customers are more selective today, so reaching an inbox simply isn't enough. The teams that focus on relevance, audience understanding, and quality over volume will continue to see the best possible results from their outreach to customers." I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com. And that's today's Business Beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
I tell you, there are still some good signs that people are out there doing good things. And when you're a kid, that's pretty unbelievable.
It is. It really is. This young lady, she just completed her freshman year at Cass Tech.
Okay.
And she is well known for earning top grades. But she says her greatest accomplishment is, you know, the way she challenges assumptions, you know, every day. She was born blind.
Born blind.
And she just completed her freshman year with a perfect 4.0 GPA, finishing first in a class of 712 students. And she's also a pianist, singer, volunteer, avid reader, baker, active member of Cass Tech's Crochet Club and Vocal Choir. And this fall, she plans to attend honors and advanced placement courses in an already demanding schedule while exploring track and poetry.
Wow. That's spectacular.
I mean.
And what have you done today?
Exactly. I just feel like I just done nothing today.
She's running circles around us.
She is. I mean,
thank God. Thank God for it.
And she is such an, to me, such an example of what you can do. This girl has a disability. She is blind, and she's doing all of this. And we have, you know, young kids who have all of their faculties, mm-hmm. and, you know, don't want to do what they need to do, and, you know, and don't do well because they're not applying themselves. You know, there are smart kids out there. Sometimes they're just not applying themselves, and they don't do well. Here's this one. I mean, just... She's not on TikTok every day.
No. Ain't nobody got time for TikTok.
No. I mean, she's playing, you know, Bach.
Yeah.
She's, you know, on the piano.
No time for that. Absolutely spectacular. Good for her.
Yes.
Really, really cool story. Meanwhile, there is a coalition of 12 states and their attorneys general, led by California, that has filed a lawsuit seeking to block Paramount Skydance's proposed acquisition of Warner Brothers. The states argue the roughly $110 billion deal would violate antitrust laws by combining two major Hollywood studios and essentially forming a monopoly of major streaming platforms and television networks, a huge portfolio all under one umbrella. What would be the potential problem with this? Let's talk about it with Daniel Crane, the Richard W. Porg Professor of Law at the University of Michigan Law. And Professor, it's great to have you. What did you make of this particular lawsuit? Were you surprised by it?
Well, good morning. No, I wasn't surprised by it. There was already a consumer case filed back in May seeking to block this deal. And I think you can think about it at two levels. One, there's a political level, and secondly, there's a legal level. At the political level, the Trump Justice Department cleared this deal, but there was speculation about the influence of Larry Ellison, who's obviously close to Trump, and his son David Ellison, who runs Paramount, as to whether that played a role. And then the 12 attorneys general you mentioned are all from blue states, and so there's equally a question about whether politics is playing a role in either direction in terms of the decisions made by these different agencies. On the legal front, I think it's a pretty close call as to whether this merger does violate the antitrust laws. It's a style as a 5-4, the big five studios going down to four through this combination. If you talk to Paramount, they would say, no, it's a market with a lot more players than that. You look at big players that have come in recently, like Netflix, Amazon, and Apple, which are creating content on par with the content typically created by the big studios. So I think it's going to be a very interesting case in terms of who actually gets the better of the facts and the law.
If this case goes to trial, Daniel, what kinds of evidence will the court be looking at? I mean, is it market share or consumer prices, internal company documents, all of the above? I don't know.
All of the above, yeah. Okay. So what I expect will happen is there'll be a preliminary injunction hearing sometime in the next few months. That may end up deciding the case, although given that we have I think $7 billion termination fee that Paramount have to pay to Warner, this is likely a case that will go all the way, including to appeal. But exactly that kind of evidence. So there, antitrust law tends to be very technical at some level. We define relevant markets. We look at concentration numbers. We look at something called the Herpendahl-Hirschman Index, which gives you a snapshot of the concentration of the market before and after the mergers. But I think a lot will turn on sort of more qualitative facts, things like really where is the competition today? If you think about it from a historical perspective, you had the movie studios, back in the day, seven or eight of them, now down to five. This deal would take them down to four. That created most of the sort of premium movie content. Is that really true today still? You have, as I said before, a lot more smaller studios and titans like Amazon and Apple and Netflix that are at some level competing. So I think a lot just will depend on how the judge thinks about this market, not just historically, but as it is today.
Mm. Fascinating.
I know the attorneys general also argue that this merger could give, one company enormous influence over news and entertainment. Does antitrust law take into account cultural influence, or is it primarily just focused on prices and competition?
That's a wonderful question, because this has very much been in debate in the last few years. There's been a whole question about the relationship between economic concentration and democracy. So to what extent should a court or the antitrust agencies think about, as you said, cultural influence or even influence on news and democracy as being something that plays out in an antitrust case? I think the technical answer is that doesn't really add a whole lot if you don't think that there is a concentration problem. And I'll just say, I think the concentration numbers here are very borderline. If you look at this tool I mentioned before, the Herfindahl-Hirschman Index, these numbers, in most cases, this kind of a merger would get through. So I think it would take some extra some extra theory about how this is going to be really bad in order for the states to prevail.
Daniel Crane, we appreciate your time. Thank you.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Yeah, interesting.
It's always something with these mergers and with the rise in streaming and, you know, I mean, because Warner Brothers and Paramount, I mean, they're just basically saying we're competing against much larger players, like he said, like Netflix and Amazon and Apple and all
that. And the other part of this, too, is the media landscape is changing.
Yes.
Right? People are not consuming their content the way they did even 10 years ago.
No.
It's completely different now. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, I mean, you look at what Amazon's doing or these other, you know, streaming platforms, they're producing content at a much lower price.
Yes.
And getting a much bigger ROI.
Yes.
Coming up on the other side, what are restaurants doing to protect customers from cyclosporiasis? It's next. So it sounds like Michigan health officials have kind of narrowed down the potential
source
of cyclosporiasis to lettuce.
Yes.
Lettuce or bags of lettuce. Mm-hmm. What was it? Leafy greens?
Leafy greens.
But they're not ruling out anything else.
Right.
Like they've talked about raspberries and cilantro, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not ruling anything else out. But lettuce seems to be, and it has been in the past, the culprit for more cases popping up. And so what do restaurants do in order to prevent something like this from originating in one of their restaurants? Well, Amanda Smith is the Executive Vice President of Workforce Development at the Michigan Restaurant and Lodging Association and joins us this morning. Amanda, it's good to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, it's when I went to the grocery store the other day and I was walking through the produce section, there was significantly less there. Some of the berries were gone, like, you know, those little standalone coolers, empty. You could tell there was far less lettuce available as well.
Yeah.
How then is that affecting the restaurant industry? Are they still able to get these ingredients, and how are they managing all of this?
Yeah, so right now they are still able to get them. There hasn't been a formal recall on any specific brand, but they're all following the CDC recommendations, washing the lettuce, removing the outer leaves, not using any bags. So those are some of the safety protocols that have been released to date.
I know many, you know, people assume restaurants just simply trust their suppliers. How extensive is the food safety system before fresh produce ever reaches a customer's plate?
Well, produce is a little bit more challenging than a lot of other things. Meat's been one of those things and historically has been recalled, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now there's so much testing in place that it never really makes it to the consumer. Produce is really hard to test. Sometimes in different outbreaks, it's grown into the plant. And it's just whether you're getting that produce in a restaurant, at the grocery store, wherever else. And we don't always cook our produce. A lot of the parasites or different foodborne illnesses with proper cooking temperature, we eliminate the health concern. A lot of produce is consumed raw, so it carries some risk.
Are you hearing from restaurants or companies that they're seeing a decline in people attending at this point?
Well, they really shouldn't be avoiding restaurants. The restaurants, you know, there hasn't been a source, right? Restaurants follow so many protocols to keep their guests safe all the time. This isn't just when there's a concern, right? Buying from a reputable supplier, you mentioned, making sure that they follow proper protocols, which in this case is washing all of the produce before it's served. You know, hand washing. I remember talking to people during COVID. I'm like, we practice hand washing every single day in a restaurant, not just during a certain outbreak, right? all the food safety standards, changing cutting boards, all those things restaurants do and are trained to do all the time. So there's no reason not to go to restaurants right now.
And, well, you know, just say for listeners who are planning to go out this week, dine out this week, are there some questions they should or shouldn't be asking, you know, their, you know, waiters or waitresses in the restaurants?
Yeah, I mean, make sure that the place that they're at knows the protocols, that they're washing all of their produce. That's about all we can do right now until we get more information from either DHHS or the CDC that tells us, you know, something different, or they say, you know, it's this specific brand or that specific brand and it's recalled. And then, of course, we'll avoid it completely. But making sure that they have some standards in place. And then if somebody's really not comfortable, there's a million other things you can eat. I know last night I made fajitas for my family. I cooked those peppers and I cooked the onions just to make sure, right? Made sure that produce was cooked down a little bit more than normal. We get to that 156 temperature that is also part of the CDC guidance.
Well, we all said we were going on the pizza diet. Didn't we say we were all?
Yeah, we're on the pizza diet right now until we get this thing figured out, Amanda.
You know, Michigan has some really incredible pizza joints.
Yes, we do.
So I think that's really good advice.
Yes, we do.
Don't forget the ice cream shops.
And ice cream.
Yes.
Yep. Ice cream day. I mean, coffee houses. There's an awful lot of things out there that you can do.
Yeah. No doubt. Amanda Smith, we appreciate your time. Thank you this morning.
Thanks.
Yeah, you got it.
Yeah, ice cream sounds good today when it's going to be, you know, a heat index of 100 degrees or better.
Better eat it quick.
Right.
You're going to be sitting in a puddle of rocky road pretty fast.
I know I got a couple of really nice ice cream shops near me, one in Berkeley, Clark's, and then one in Royal Oak. Ray's, of course, are great. And let me tell you, on a day like this, you go past, it's going to be a line.
I will tell you, like, growing up, it's always been Guernsey's for me. Guernsey's. Always Guernsey's.
Guernsey's.
I mean, I
100%.
Grew up around the corner. Guernsey's is the spot, right? And they got the big rock out front. You go, you get your ice cream, you go sit outside. Kids run around, probably fall off a rock. They cry for a minute, and then they continue to eat their ice cream. It's tradition.
Well, listen, and Guernsey's has more than just the ice cream. I mean, they have some other great stuff, everything. Too. So
they have the greatest breakfast burrito I've ever seen or ate. I love it.
It's a one-stop shop over there.
Oh, yeah.
All of it's great. But, like, local ice cream parlors are the best.
Well, just so you have something to look forward to, both of you, I'm off Friday. A Friday, Ray's Ice Cream will be coming into the studio to bring you some ice cream.
Look at that.
So
you talked it up. I just talked it up.
Yeah!
Talk it up.
How about that?
Ask and you shall receive.
Look at that. Didn't even know.
Nope.
Didn't even know. Some good news for the Rocket Classic coming up here in just a couple of days. Brooks Koepka has committed to play in this tournament. A tournament official confirmed Koepka's commitment yesterday. This is from a Tony Paul piece in the Detroit News. It'll be the first time for Brooks Koepka playing in the Rocket Classic. And this is the final tournament, unfortunately. Yeah. Uh-huh. But this is a pretty darn good field. And you know, there has been criticisms that the field hasn't been as strong in the past.
Yeah.
But you've got the number four player in the world in Cameron Young. You've got Wyndham Clark, who's a two-time U.S. Open champion, number eight in the world. Xander Schauffele's playing. He's number 14 in the world. And Koepka now becoming the first player to leave the PGA Tour for LIV Golf, then coming back to the PGA Tour. And he will be in Detroit playing.
All good stuff, man.
Awesome.
They're going out with a bang.
They are.
You know?
They are. And it's great. Because again, it's good for the city. Even if this is truly the last one, you know, having those eyeballs. And again, Brooks, the story of Brooks Koepka playing is going to be a story in and of itself.
Yeah, absolutely.
So even the attention on this tournament goes up even further. I think it's pretty darn cool. You ever have a problem with loud cars?
Yes, I was a loud car yesterday, and it was
like driving past your house or on the road or whatever.
It was a Cadillac.
It was a Cadillac.
It was a Cadillac.
A souped-up Cadillac?
Yeah, it was like a Cadillac SUV, but it had, like, you know, two exhausts, dual exhaust, and it was just loud. I don't know it's like maybe they made it that way. I don't think, you know, Cadillac made it that way. I think this person made it that way, but it was just loud.
Well, there is some new legislation that is aiming to stop loud cars.
Huh.
And we'll talk about it next.
Okay.
Here on JR Morning. So an effort in Lansing to quiet some noisy cars on the road is bipartisan. It would give law enforcement broader authority to ticket drivers with modified or excessively loud exhaust systems and increase fines for these violations, especially if they're repeat offenders. Representative Jason Hoskins out of the 18th District and Natalie Price out of Berkeley have been working on this as well, and they join us this morning. It's good to talk with you both.
Great to be on. Thanks for including us.
Yeah. Jason, where did this idea come from?
Well, we've heard from so many constituents who've, you know, just been trying to relax and enjoy peace and quiet at home. And you hear these loud noises. And so when you hear from a variety of people who are, you know, veterans, people with young kids, people with pets, you know, we wanted to be able to try to tackle this problem for them.
And, you know, there is a difference between someone enjoying a classic car and someone in, you know, intentionally creating excessive noise. How do you draw that line in a way that kind of respects both residents and those automotive enthusiasts?
Well, in the state's vehicle code, we have currently certain decibels that are set, and this legislation is right in line with those decibels. So we're just trying to enforce when somebody modifies their vehicle to make it excessively loud in comparison to those approved standard decibel levels. That's what we're trying to address with this legislative update.
So under the current law, drivers cited for an illegal exhaust will face a $100 fine. Representative Hoskins, how does that change under this legislation?
So under this new legislation, we raised the penalties to $500 for the first offense. And even under that first offense, if you simply remove that modification and show that to a court, we'll waive that first offense. But then after that, it goes up for the second and third offenses, it goes up to $1,000. And we work with our law enforcement, our friends in law enforcement, to really work out those new fines, because they wanted to make sure they had more teeth.
I know Representative Hoskins, I hear that there's been some concerns from lawmakers in rural areas who kind of wonder if this could affect people statewide. How do you make sure this law works in communities with, you know, different environments?
You know, and that is a fun part of lawmaking. We're working with our colleagues right now to figure out that balance. In areas, in urban areas, we are dealing with this a lot. It is certainly not something that Representative Price and I are dealing with in our area. It is something that is happening around the state. And so it is about us, you know, conveying that to our colleagues who may not live and who may live in rural areas about the real importance of this. And that's one of the good things about this process, is we get to work together and find something that's equitable for everybody.
Representative Price, you know, there are people out there that are saying, well, hold on. If I want to have this on my car, that's my business. That's not anybody else's business. Live and let live, if you will. We do have a law in the book currently, but what's the message to those folks?
Well, this is the old, you know, your freedom to swing your fist ends with my face. I understand that people care a lot, especially in the Motor City, about their vehicles and being able to showcase their vehicles. And I love that. Me and a lot of people working on this, we love the Jim Cruise. We love the appreciation of unique vehicles. The problem is when you modify your vehicle to be excessively loud over the approved decibel standards, you are swinging your fist into somebody's face. You are doing them real measurable harm to their ability to sleep, recover, enjoy their porch, and their property values. All of these things are being impacted by excessively loud modified exhaust systems. And that's really where we have to draw the line and allow our local law enforcement to enforce the law as it was designed.
And Representative Hoskins, the bill's now head to the House Transportation Committee. What changes or maybe compromises you expect as you kind of work to build some support among lawmakers?
You know, I'm working with the chair of that committee, the Transportation Committee, Representative Outman, to really work out those changes. And as we go through the summer, hopefully we'll be able to get some things together to be able to bring forward to the committee for a hearing.
And if these bills become law, what should residents, you know, kind of realistically expect next summer? Will they notice an immediate difference?
That is the hope. It will certainly give our friends in law enforcement more tools, because one of the issues is that when we talk to police chiefs in the area, the people who have these excessively loud cars, they're paying the fines. The fines are not deterring them from doing this. And hopefully the goal with this is that this will truly be a deterrent and people will be able to enjoy a little peace next summer.
Representative Jason Hoskins and Representative Natalie Price, thank you for your time on this. We'll keep an eye on it and keep us updated, will you please?
Wonderful. Yeah, thanks for spreading the word.
Yeah, you got it. Thanks for your time this morning.
Yeah, it gets loud on what, but I can't say is.
But that's what you expect during the Dream Cruise.
Well, yeah, but I can't say it's just a Dream Cruise issue. I mean, there are like I told you, there are people who will be sitting out in lawn chairs this weekend, looking at cars go up and down Woodward Avenue, and there'll be some souped up cars and some classic cars going down. I mean, the Dream Cruise isn't until next month, but they'll sit up there and they'll watch the cars, and there'll be loud cars. And, you know, Berkeley is right there. You got homes right there. And I just think, if you soup it up, you pay to soup up your car to make it louder than, you know, more than the decibel that's allowed. That's an issue.
I got to be honest. It's never really bothered me. The only time it's ever bothered me is when my kids are asleep and I'm like, if that exhausts wakes up my kids,
well, yeah.
I have a moment of peace. I need this kid to go to sleep. I need quiet for 10 minutes. And then you hear.
Yeah. No, there's a lot of that. A lot of people feel the same way in those neighboring areas, though.
But for the most part, I don't really care. I think they're kind of cool. Again, it's not my thing.
Yeah.
But, if you're into that, cool. God bless.
It's pointless.
What do you have? It's not silly. Pointless.
It is pointless. It's just dumb noise. Why are you making dumb noise?
Because it sounds like.
It sounds cool.
It's cool.
Cool, something's wrong with you.
Maybe,
it's not cool.
Maybe you're a communist. It sounds like pure American power. That's what it sounds like.
It sounds like you're compensating for something.
Listen, Stalin.
Oh, my God.
That is pure American power.
We were sitting home one day, Bev and I, and it was a nice, quiet neighborhood, and this moron across the street fired his car up, and we both like I nearly fell out of my chair. It was so loud.
What are you drinking, Haterade this morning?
Let's pass the law that if your car is too loud, I can come over and slap you. How about that? That's the law.
Let people
so
live.
Much violence. I hate that. So much violence.
Just
Lloyd just wants us all to get along.
Can we all just get along?
Let people do their thing.
Thank God for a commercial break coming up here.
They're not hurting anybody. All right, we got to go to a break. 8 o'clock hour coming up. It's Jared Morning. All right, 8 o'clock hour, going to be a hot one today. It's going to feel like it's above 100 degrees. And thankfully, the city will have cooling centers all around. So
yes.
Those will be available to people.
All the rec centers will be open, libraries in the city.
But I just don't, try to stay in if you can.
Yeah.
It makes going out a lot less enjoyable.
Definitely.
You know, it's like, maybe I should just bring a lunch today. Do I really need to go out for lunch? It's going to be, I think the sidewalk will be melting. I don't know.
Don't go out barefoot.
Yeah, no, no.
You'll burn your feet.
Don't do that. But keep your pets at home, you know, things like that.
Please
check on the loved ones in your life to make sure
the
that
elderly,
they're,
yes, make sure
their air is not working and they're okay.
Yes.
That's all you can do. Meanwhile, we think that the state has maybe possibly narrowed down, but they can't quite confirm the cause of cyclosporiasis and where it's coming from.
No, they say that lettuce and salad greens are now the leading suspected source.
Salad and lettuce has taken the lead.
Yes. The Michigan Department of Health and Human Services reports that more than 2,600 cases statewide, far above the normal 40 to 50 that we usually get a year here in Michigan. Investigators have not identified a specific grower or supplier, but officials are urging consumers to buy whole heads of lettuce. Don't buy that bagged salad mix. And they also say discard the outer leaves of that whole head of lettuce and wash the remaining leaves thoroughly. Cook greens whenever possible because that kills the parasite. Health officials say contaminated produce remains the focus of the investigation, while recreational swimming is not believed to be a source of the outbreak. And then, you know, there have been some people who have been let go from the CDC in that specific department that tracks these foodborne illnesses. There've been some layoffs and things there. So they say that's kind of helping to make this slow stroll in trying to find out what's going on and where this is exactly coming from, because we have less people dealing with it at the CDC.
Well, again, though, it's been pretty standard in the past.
Yeah.
Like where this is coming from.
Yeah.
I remember last week when we talked to Natasha Bagdasarian, the chief medical officer here in Michigan, you know, she said, you know, usually it's lettuce. Usually it's, something in produce, usually lettuce. That's where it usually comes from. But they were still trying to track it down. Usually, and she even highlighted it, and if you missed the interview, you can go to WJR.com. It's there. But like locally, local health officials are doing a lot of that groundwork for them.
Yeah.
So they'll say, what'd you eat last week?
Mm-hmm.
Or what'd you eat 2 weeks ago? I don't know how you remember that. I don't.
Remember how what I ate 2 days ago.
Right. So it's tough. And as somebody who has this thing, it's like, I don't remember what I ate. We were talking about it in one of the breaks.
Yeah.
It's like, I have no idea. Not a clue what I ate. Because it's different. You do whatever. Yeah. Different things. But I have no idea. And I don't know how I'm the only one in my family that got it. That's the crazy part.
Michigan, you know, is the hardest hit state. I mean, it's in 33 states at this point, but its hardest hit is Michigan and Ohio.
Yep.
44 people have been sent to the hospital because this, you know, you dehydrate.
In Michigan.
Yeah, in Michigan.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you dehydrate with the, you know, diarrhea dehydrates you, and some people are not getting enough, and so they have to pump them with IV.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the president says that they're going to take control of the strait.
We're taking out all of their capability for anything having to do with the strait, with the Hormuz Strait. And I think in the end, we will end up just controlling the whole thing.
The naval blockade is set to be put back into place. It's going to be effective as of 4 o'clock this afternoon. And one of the things that the president has talked about is a 20% fee on these cargo ships. He says,
we are going to be reimbursed for protection. We're protecting by the countries that we're helping.
I don't know how that would be put into place. I don't think a PayPal account has been set up, as far as I know.
Well, and they didn't like it when Iran did it.
No, I didn't like it when Iran was talking about it.
Yeah, so I don't know how we were able to change it for us. It's okay for us to do it.
Now, the genius of the blockade initially was that you were cutting off everything to Iran.
Yes.
The downside of that is everybody was suffering, including here in the United States. And the cost of oil has gone
oil
up
is
into
up.
The 80s.
$80
today.
Over 80. Yeah.
We'll talk to Patrick DeHaan coming up next on gas, on the gas front. But as it pertains to Iran and what the United States is doing now is they have effectively, the memorandum of understanding is gone. Whatever ceasefire, the 60-day ceasefire that was put into place as a result of that memorandum, basically gone, because the United States is carrying out actions militarily on Iran, particularly along the coast, but even more inland now, and even potentially hitting one of the areas where they think is a nuclear site, which is this Pickaxe Mountain. So that is an area where they could potentially be targeting as well for a military action. So they haven't relented, that's for sure.
South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster has appointed Darlene Graham Nordone, the sister of the late Senator Lindsey Graham, to fill his U.S. Senate seat through the remainder of his term. Graham, as you know, died over the weekend at the age of 71 from what the medical examiner says was likely an aortic dissection, a tear in the body's main artery. Nordone has never held elected office, but shared a close bond with her brother, who became her legal guardian after their father's death and later adopted her. She will serve until January, while South Carolina voters elect a senator to a full 6-year term in November following the Republican primary in August.
She has not been very political over the years.
Mm-mm.
This would be her first real political position. She was in her brother's campaign commercial at one point.
Mm-hmm.
In 2019, she was the commissioner and agency head for the South Carolina Commission for the Blind, which administers vocational rehabilitation, independent living, and blindness prevention programs for South Carolinians who are blind or have low vision. She's done a lot of work in helping people with disabilities that that need some sort of help. So she's done good stuff.
And she's got the support of the president. I know the president said that's who he would like to see. And
yeah, it's certainly ceremonial. She'll be leaning heavily on the staff that her brother had in place. It's just a terrible situation. And again, she's not running for office again.
No.
She's just filling out the rest of his term.
Yeah. The People Mover was shut down overnight because of a system-wide software glitch. They suspended all service for last evening to allow maintenance crews to investigate the issue. They have found the issue. I was just informed that the People Mover opened as usual this morning, and it is moving people as we speak.
Oh, good.
Just in case you missed my dulcet tones of telling you what stop you were getting off at, it's back up now.
There's a Ward Manual controversy now.
Oh, man.
At the University of Michigan, because a new report could be coming out as early as this week that highlights potentially some, people knew about Sharon Moore and the staffer, or people knew about the cheating scandal and basically covered it up.
Well, and Ward says, he told Yahoo Sports that he has no plans to step down, saying he expects to remain athletic director. Well, okay, you may not have plans to step down yourself, but depending what's in this report, the university may have other plans.
Yes, for sure. You watching the MLB All-Star game tonight?
No.
Okay. Jason? I know Brian ain't watching that.
That's no.
Negative.
Okay.
Not a fan of really any of the sports.
The All-Star
games, yeah.
Oh, Riley Green will start in left field. How about that?
Don't get hurt.
All-Star starter.
Don't get hurt.
Riley, agree. Don't get hurt. He gets one pop fly, and that's it. Pull him.
Right. I know that's right.
Give him the hook. I did catch a little bit of the home run derby last night on Netflix.
That?
Glorified batting practice, my friends.
It's just not for me.
Okay.
The one dude from Kansas City hit a 477-foot bomb, though. That was impressive.
They said the guy from Tampa hit a 491.
Yes, I missed that one, but I did see 477.
Almost 500 feet.
She's absolutely unbelievable.
I mean, but has anybody ever, knocked it out of the ballpark like Cecil did back in the day? Cecil Fielder.
Well, it depends on what ballpark.
Yeah,
if you're in San Francisco, they'll hit it into the bay.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, so you got to have the opening.
I just remember Cecil hitting it, over the roof at Tiger Stadium.
I forget where they used to hit them, but there was an auto shop across the street.
Yeah.
Where the balls would land in the auto shop parking lot.
That's right.
And break some of the windshields.
And then they'd have to fix. Yeah, they have to fix that. Gas prices on the rise again. A cost of a barrel of oil is going up. We'll talk to Patrick DeHaan on the other side. It's JR Morning.
I like that music.
Do you?
Yeah. Sounds like the ice cream man coming down the street on a hot day.
It kind of does.
Yeah.
Yay.
On a hot day, that, you know.
Yeah. Crude oil prices are going up. Brent crude surging to $87 a barrel. West Texas Intermediate up to $79, $80 a barrel. So we're seeing the immediate impact of what's unfolding in the Middle East in real time. What does that mean for you at the gas pump? Let's talk about it. Patrick DeHaan, the senior petroleum analyst at GasBuddy.com. Patrick, good to have you back. We're starting to see these prices go back up. What does it mean for us?
Yeah, exactly right. And probably we'll start noticing more of that even today. As you mentioned, crude oil prices up pretty dramatically yesterday. And looks like we're continuing to climb this morning up another 2.5% to $80 a barrel. What it means is that we'll probably see the national average reaching $4 a gallon. That could happen here later this week. The national average is at $3.81. In Michigan, we're already a little bit higher at $3.90. I believe that in very short order, we could see prices in Michigan jumping as they do during cycling days, I think today or tomorrow. I don't see how they'd wait until tomorrow, given the wholesale price went up yesterday. But we could see a fairly big jump starting today. It could be tomorrow. The jump that we saw in the market yesterday, stations were paying that last night. and they haven't yet passed it along. So it's coming. It's just a matter of when.
Is this a short-term spike, or should we prepare for prices to kind of continue climbing throughout the rest of the summer?
You know, I'd like to think it's a short-term spike, but, I mean, the entire, you know, memorandum of understanding, the ceasefire is now behind us, and there's new attacks. So I don't think it's going to be short-term for now, but I don't know how long-term it's going to be either, right? This is one of those things where I don't have a crystal ball, and it really is contingent on how long the situation escalates. And that's the phase we're back into. And by the way, it's not just the Strait of Hormuz. In the last 6 weeks, we've seen more and more Ukrainian attacks on Russian oil refineries. And I want to say probably a fourth of the time that you guys have me on, it's something about a refinery here and there.
Mm-hmm.
And though those refineries overseas are not in our backyard, Russia is such a significant exporter of diesel. 1 in 9 barrels of diesel produced comes from Russia. Not anymore. Because of the attacks, Russia has banned exports. They're keeping all of their products in their country because there's not enough fuel for even themselves. They mm-hmm. have not enough fuel to even export. And so part of why we're going to be digging deeper is not just the Strait of Hormuz, though that is the biggest shift, but it's also because Ukraine is attacking Russian oil refineries. And you can't build an oil refinery overnight. And that's the problem. You know, a lot of Americans look at the price of oil. We talk about oil every day. But oil is only one of the components in gasoline. And the other factor here is that just there's not, you know, you can't build another refinery overnight. So I'm expecting to see prices at the retail level go up probably as early as today. How long they stay there? Well, we have a short-term potential escalation with the U.S. and Iran. And I think the Ukraine-Russia situation, the attacks on refineries, that may be longer lasting.
Yeah.
I think Ukraine is figuring out a way to really stick it to Russia.
So if you go back to before this conflict started, a cost of a barrel, and I don't know the exact number, but it was around $65 a barrel, and then we saw the price jump. Is the jumping off point now, if this continues to escalate, are we jumping off from $80 a barrel? And what does that do for the cost?
Yeah, there's been a lot of the comparison of pre-war. You know, the price of oil was this, the price of gasoline was that. There's a lot to explain the disconnect. The seasonality, the summer blends that we've been switched to kind of distort that. In addition, the lack of refinery capacity overseas distorts that. Higher demand distorts that. You know, so we'd probably see the national average at over $4 a gallon, even though oil just hit $80. I know a lot of people will say, well, back in 2008, it didn't hit $4 until oil hit $150. But that's only looking at the price of oil, right? If you look at inflation of wages, property taxes, property values, the cost of doing business, all of that's gone up. So there's not really a magic ratio that really exists anymore. Some of it is seasonality. That is, if we're in January, $80 oil is going to bring us a vastly lower price because lower demand and cheaper winter gasoline. But on top of that, that's why I mentioned the Russia, the attacks on Russian refineries, is that's leading to a bit of a disconnect right now. So, you know, for the time being, $80 oil is probably going to mean close to $4 gasoline, and that's because of all the things I mentioned. The cost of business, taxes have gone up. Michigan's gasoline tax has gone up dramatically since people make that 2008 comparison.
If you were advising, you know, drivers on what to expect between now and Labor Day, Patrick, would you tell them to fill up before that road trip now, or do you think there's still a chance that prices could ease again?
You know, I really don't see much of that potential. There's more risk to the upside right now than downside. If you're listening this morning, I'd probably fill my tank up because I'm expecting prices in Michigan to go back above the $4 a gallon mark. They could hit $4.19. They could go even higher than that. So I'm seeing that stations in real time this morning, anyone that's got a tanker truck paid a lot more for that gasoline, and that's why it's very likely in my head that sometime today or tomorrow we'll start to see prices go up. And then for the rest of the summer, based on where we are, unless there's de-escalations with the U.S. and Iran, I do think we'll probably stick closer to the $4 or even above the $4 mark. It's a developing situation, right? Gasoline and oil prices almost never hold still. As long as there's new news, as long as there's continued escalations and attacks, you know, this is a kind of a daily, you know, if you watch the price of oil, it's moving constantly.
Yeah.
So gasoline is going to be moving constantly based on whatever the new developments look like. And I wish I had that crystal ball to tell you it's going to be higher today or lower tomorrow. But for now, it looks like the trend is going to be upward. And I think it could last at least a few weeks.
Well, if you do ever do get that crystal ball going and you want to tell us lottery numbers, we'd appreciate that too.
You know, as long as I get a hand in the winnings.
Oh, absolutely.
Of course.
Yes.
Yes. Patrick DeHaan, appreciate you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, you got it. And of course, the DOJ is looking into, you know, whether or not these gas stations are price gouging, companies are price gouging, things like that. So that's all in the fold as well. Coming up on the other side, what happens to mechanics in a time when cars are getting more technologically savvy? It's next.
I think Jason's DJing this morning, man. He's
playing spinning
it. Some hot tunes this morning.
Okay. Spinning it. Well, if you've bought a car in the last 5 years, you've seen an increase in your technology.
Yeah.
It's been a big jump. And it was funny because I was talking about this with somebody the other day. You know, there used to be more like mom and pop mechanic shops.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
Where if you just needed something, you needed a new spark plug or you needed whatever.
Get some brakes or something like that. Yeah.
They'll take care of you. And it was reasonably priced and all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's, I feel like I see less of them now. And partly because the technology that goes in these vehicles, they're not equipped for that. That's not something that they necessarily can handle. And certainly with electric vehicles,
yeah,
if there need to be some sort of repairs made, I don't know if, you know, your standard mom and pop mechanic can fix those.
No, sometimes things have to be reset in your computer module, and they can't do it. You got to take it back to the dealership because they can do it. I was at a dealership and I heard somebody say, well, yeah, your computer chip, something isn't working and it's going to need to be repaired. How much is it? Oh, it's going to be about $3,400.
Right. So it was an interesting topic that I was talking about with somebody. And then I see in the Detroit News, they've covered this story. And Carl Brower is the executive analyst for iccars.com and joins us to talk about it. Carl, good morning. It's good to have you.
Hey, great to be on with you guys.
So what is the state of your local mechanic shop, because these vehicles are way more than they used to bargain for?
Well, there's a spectrum, of course, of capabilities for independent shops, but there are certainly plenty of shops out there with, you know, certified mechanics, ASC certified technicians who can handle even the most modern vehicles' repair demands as far as the technology goes. What's trickier is whether they have the ability to do it because of access to information. And I think that's where the real battle has been discussed, is if you've got, for instance, updated software that's becoming available for these cars, or you've got a bunch of information that's come back because the car is tracking everything that's going on and keeping a record of it, and that helps diagnose and fix these problems, but only the manufacturer and the manufacturer's official dealers, the dealer-branded dealers, are getting access to that information, then that's going to reduce the independent shop's ability to repair the vehicle. And that's what kind of is the big battle now for right to repair. And what they're saying is that, you know, manufacturers are claiming, well, for safety, we can't have people who don't really know what they're doing fixing these cars. And it's like they kind of don't add in, well, the reason they may not know what they're doing is because you're not giving them the information that you've got access to because of all the connected car technology to help them fix the cars. And, you know, if only the dealers have that information, it just, like any supply-demand situation, it would mean more people would have to go to the dealers. They wouldn't have the option to use independent shops, and the dealers would potentially start to have more of a monopoly and charge more money to get your car repaired.
Well, you know, the average driver may not think about repair access when they buy a car. So should consumers now be asking a question about, like, hey, how easy is it for this vehicle to be repaired before they purchase it?
I think it's absolutely, you know, realistic for consumers to consider, if I'm buying a new car, what are my options to get it repaired outside the dealer network, the official dealer network that's branded for that vehicle? And again, most people do that. Believe it or not, most people think that, well, when you buy a new car, of course you go back to the dealer for service, if not forever, at least initially during the warranty period. A certain amount of people do that, but plenty of people right off the bat either fix the car themselves at home or they take it to an independent shop, which is good, by the way, because in theory, if all the cars that were sold new had to be serviced only at dealers, the dealers wouldn't have the ability to do it. Mm-hmm. They'd be overwhelmed with too many cars. But, I mean, if you live in a given location, it would behoove you to look through independent shops that are local to you and say, hey, I'm about to buy one of these. Do you have the ability to fix most, if not all, of the problems that come up with it?
Hmm. The president seems like this is on his radar as well, that he spoke to leaders of Ford and General Motors about the ability for these places or people to have access to that information that you talked about to fix their own vehicles. It's kind of been dubbed this right to repair legislation. Where is that at?
Yeah, he wants people to be able to fix their own vehicles. And he thinks that that shouldn't even be a question. Like anything, if you buy something in this country, the thought is that you now own it and you can do what you need to with it, whether it's fix it yourself, take it to a independent shop, or go back to the official dealer branded dealers and get it fixed. So he certainly wants that right to repair, as they say, for anyone, and have as much freedom and latitude as possible. And it's interesting because there was this attempt to kind of push toward less control over this by some of the dealers and the manufacturers, and that put it on the radar for him, and he pushed it back the other direction.
Mm.
So you got these vehicles now that are even more connected, electric, software-driven. What does that mean for, you know, auto repair now? I mean, will these independent mechanics adapt, or could we just see fewer of them in our neighborhoods now?
If, in theory, they were unable to keep repairing newer cars as readily as they have been repairing them in the past, it would absolutely start cutting into their business and could ultimately drive many of them out of business. There'll always be a certain amount of older used cars that are much easier to access and repair for any kind of shop. But over time, if they couldn't work on newer cars, it would be bad for the independent mechanics and shop industry.
How much is the cost for the software to get these updates for these cars? Like it sounds like it would be much more financially attainable for a dealership than it would be for an independent mechanic.
Yeah, and I mean, and I don't know kind of the exact figures and all that. I think a lot of that is still kind of what's being trying to be determined. Because I mean, if you think about it, it's like so many things when it comes to technology, there's really not a big cost, and the scale is like minimal, right? Once you have the coding, once you have a software update that's been figured out probably by the engineers at the automaker, distributing it, whether it's to your own branded dealers or to all the independent shops and the branded dealers, is very inexpensive. I mean, we now know there's over-the-air updates, right, where cars can actually have updates to their software while they're sitting in your garage in the middle of the night and you're not driving them. So it really shouldn't be, I can tell you this, it shouldn't be expensive to get access to this information, because all you're really doing is transmitting data over a network.
Interesting. Carl Brower with iccars.com. Thank you. Really appreciate the insight on this.
Absolutely. Fun being on with you guys.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thanks for your time. Meanwhile, coming up on the other side, what have we learned from the debates thus far?
What maybe the other person is not going to do and what that person did. And
it's their fault, not mine.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Can't buy me.
We'll talk about it coming up on the other side. It's Chair Morning. All right, a little bit of good breaking news. Consumer prices were up 3.5% in June. From a year earlier, according to the Labor Department. Today, that's cooler than it was last month at 4.2%. So, saw a decline in the inflationary number, which is good
news. That's a good thing.
Last month, though, we did get a break in gasoline prices.
Mm-hmm.
So, that probably helped.
Yes.
But
we ain't getting a break right now.
As long as that number is going down,
not up. Yeah.
That would be good. There have been a number of different debates for all of us to take in. And the idea of these debates, at least in theory, is that we are bringing a meeting of the minds together and hashing out ideas. And right now it's party against party.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. We're not to November yet.
No.
We're just fighting for the spot.
No, it's not the other side. It's just one side against each other.
So they really haven't been yet fighting for everybody's votes yet. They're just fighting for enough votes to get in
through the primary.
And so it feels like we've had more of a contrast in styles as opposed to a contrast in ideas on how they would govern or legislate, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. ML Elric has been keeping an eye on this for the Detroit Free Press and joins us this morning. ML, it's good to have you back. You've watched all of these debates. What has been your takeaway thus far?
Yeah, Chris, you're absolutely right. These are family feuds right now, and you're not going to find Democrats disagreeing on whether President Trump is taking us in the right direction. And you're not going to find Republicans saying, oh, yeah, I want to keep the state income tax. They're arguing over some basic stuff like who can win. And they're talking about their records, their track record of accomplishment. They're talking about who's most likely to be victorious against the other party if they win the nomination. And then some of it is style. And if you think it's hot out there, you should get in a room with these candidates because they're coming down to the wire. They're fighting for political survival, and they're not taking any hostages.
I mean, you know, in a primary election, ML, you know, candidates often, you know, they have to appeal to their party's base before reaching out for that broader electorate. How much did these debates, you think, reveal about where each party's voters are right now?
Well, the Democratic primary is absolutely going to be one of those things, Lloyd, where we see where the party's at. Because what you have right now is you have a very liberal candidate in Abdul El-Sayed, who's been endorsed by Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, going against Haley Stevens, who's a very establishment Democrat, who's been endorsed by Chuck Schumer, Gary Peters, Debbie Stabenow, all the old line Democrats. And I know this is, I hate the term inflection point, and I don't want to say this is a battle for the soul of the Democratic Party, but what we're going to see here is whether we're going to have a generational change in the Democrats, because young progressives are very upset about what's been going on in Gaza and the conduct of Israel, and older establishment Democrats like Haley Stevens, who frankly isn't very old herself, but the crowd she runs with is, they want to take a more moderate position where they're like, well, you know, we're not really happy with Netanyahu, but we still have to be strong for Israel. And this is a schism that tore the Democratic Party apart in 2024 and cost Kamala Harris the election. So this is huge for the Democrats. The Republicans, it's more a matter of style. And frankly, if you're a Republican, if you got Trump, you're sitting pretty. If you don't, it's going to take a miracle.
Yeah, and I think for a lot of folks, especially if they aren't dialed in, right? We're dialed in.
Yeah.
And that's our job, and that's what we like to do. But for people that aren't necessarily hip on everything that these candidates are talking about, it's like, I would like less sizzle, more steak. Give me more of how you would do things or what you think should be done, as opposed to, well, I don't think Abdul can win. Or I think, you know, I've got the endorsement of Donald Trump, and I think that's what makes the difference. Like, to me, that's all fine and dandy, but, like, how do you see things running?
So this is one of the problems with the debates.
And you did have a Freudian slip when you said the primary survivor. I actually think that might be an effective way of picking some of these candidates if we have to put out flames with a little bowl.
Well, you know, we did see some of them competing on an island, Mackinac Island.
That's true.
It looked to me that they all had to leave the tribe. But
it's a little more glamorous there.
Yeah, and
a little cooler.
Yes.
So Fox 2 and Wood TV did a great job on the debates. Roop Raj and Rick Albin, they really know the issues. They really know the candidates. But I think if you want to have these debates be as good as they can possibly be, you have a panel of watchdog reporters, Capitol reporters, who when these folks say something like, well, I'm the only one to do this, or I voted for this, somebody can say, no, 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 you've been saying that all along. That's not true. That's not what we saw. Where we can fact check them in real time because, you know, sadly, people watch the debates and then they move on. They've had all they can take. They don't get that follow-up that you see from the Detroit News, from the Detroit Free Press, from MLive, from Bridge, Michigan, where we go back, we dig in, and we say, they said this, but it's not quite true. And you're seeing a lot of the claims made by the candidates start to get picked apart by reporters who are seeing what their main issues are and have the time now to kind of drill down to the bottom and see if what they're saying stands up to close scrutiny. And oftentimes it doesn't, or it's exaggerated.
It's going to crescendo here.
Oh, it's definitely going to do that.
In the next couple of weeks, and we'll see who rises to the top. ML Elric, always good catching up. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, guys. You know, you're going to get a lot coming in the mailbox from these candidates. Put it aside. Listen to Chris. Listen to Lloyd. Read the Free Press. Read the news. Get the real truth.
That's exactly right. Appreciate you, ML.
That's it in a nutshell.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
We'll talk again soon. Yeah, there's no doubt. And again, I think that when the best thing for you as a voter is to just be informed.
That's it.
So and unfortunately, with the way that these debates are set up, like sometimes you got to do the heavy lifting yourself, right?
More so now than ever.
You got to get to their websites and you got to look at what they're
more so now than ever. Out.
Or just listen to us and read ML.
There you go.
It's very simple. That's going to do it for us. Have yourself a wonderful Tuesday. Ulta coming up next right here on WGR. We'll see you tomorrow.